So first, let me. By the way, there are seats in the front for some of you who are back there if you want to work your way up. First of all, let me thank Vila for that fantastically generous introduction. She had been a student of Louis Marin's, and Louis had brought me to Paris, and we met, and then you came to Johns Hopkins, and that was great. One of the things you mentioned early on was the idea of friendship, which I got a kick out of, because that, in fact, has been tremendously important to me. I've been extremely, when I put it, metaphysically fortunate in my life in terms of contacts and friendships. And for me, a very crucial one was going to college, going to Princeton as an undergraduate. And I went there sort of ridiculously young, not because I had been recognized for any outstanding qualities in writing, just the way the things worked in New York City schools at that time. I ended up going to college at 16. And that may seem crazy, but what it meant was, had I not gotten there at 16, had I got there at 18, I would not have met Frank Stella, who was a sophomore when I was a freshman. And I was talking to Frank's daughter about this evening, but I actually have been talking about it to other people over the last couple of days. It was an extraordinary stroke of luck. I had painted and drawn as a kid. I'd gone to art school and so on and so forth. I knew I wasn't going to be an artist. I got to Princeton. I became interested in writing poetry. I submitted poems to the literary magazine. They accepted some, and they invited me in the fall of my first year to come to a meeting of the handful of people at a place like Princeton that were interested in putting out a literary magazine. And there was a guy sitting on the couch with a black magic marker and a big notebook, just paying, in a sense, no visible attention to what was going on, but making large abstract drawings. I was sitting near, I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything. Now they look like a cross between Klein and de Kooning, but they were stunning, and they were done with this kind of absolute conviction. He'd turn the page and make and that was Stella. And he was a sophomore. He didn't write, but he did covers for the journal. We very quickly became friends. And what that meant was that from the age of 16, I was introduced through Frank to abstract art, right? I took literature. Well, the great thing about an American college is you take courses in a lot of different subjects. And I took English courses and art history courses and so on. But knowing Frank and knowing a slightly older friend of Frank's who became a friend of mine named Darby Bannard, we suddenly abstract art was something we talked about all the time. This was the 1950s, and New York was exploding. And we were actually going to the library and finding back issues of magazines to read Clement Greenberg, who was the only critic who seemed to us worth reading. And you'd go into New York. Princeton was an hour from New York, and you could see incredible art. I remember once during my undergraduate years going to the Sidney Janis Gallery where there was a Rothko show. And I was looking at the Rothkos, and I became aware that this other guy in the room was Rothko. Rothko could see that I knew it was Rothko. And so there were just the two of us in this room, and at a certain point he came over towards me and he said, "See that one?" I said, "Yeah." He said, $30,000. That was the whole conversation. In my junior year of college, I actually sent Clement Greenberg a note, and could I come visit him because I liked his criticism. This is before he published Art and Culture. The essays were not available in book form at that time. And I went and saw him in New York and so on and so forth. But all of this was crucially because of Frank, and then the ability to talk to Frank about these issues. Frank was and is an extraordinarily brilliant person in addition to everything else. So friendship, those things can be just incredibly important. And then I got a scholarship that took me to Oxford. at the very moment that Stella was about to exhibit his black stripe paintings in New York. In fact, maybe two nights before I sailed to Oxford, Frank and I were taken out to dinner by Johns and Rauschenberg for, as I remember, a sort of Chinese meal. And this is what eyewitness accounts are worth. I remember nothing of what we talked about that evening. I mean, I don't have one single memory from that evening, even though I knew this was Johns and Rauschenberg, and I should try to remember. There's nothing that I remember. But then I sailed from New York and Frank and the cutting edge of modernism to the Middle Ages. Right? And suddenly I was in the Middle Ages for 2 years. And then I lived in London for a year before coming back to America. And the job of being an art critic, writing a London letter for Arts Magazine, suddenly came open. And I had written trial art reviews as an undergraduate for Hilton Kramer when he was an editor at Arts. And he offered me this position. So suddenly, at the age of 22 now, I was writing regular art criticism, appearing in New York, coming out of London. I got paid $75 a month. That paid the rent in London, my share of the rent at that time. And the very first show I went to cover, I was invited to a dinner afterwards. I thought, this is unbelievable. I'm actually going to get dinners. And I was seated opposite a sort of surly-looking guy who said, when are you going to come and see my work? I thought, this is not so great. I went the next weekend, and that was Anthony Caro. And I walked into his courtyard and saw his sculptures and was swept away and had a whole lifetime of friendship with Caro. So friendships and the sheer luck of certain encounters is totally crucial. And then returning to do graduate work at Harvard, and that very same fall meeting Stanley Cavell, who was just in the process of arriving. And, you know, that whole friendship and going to Johns Hopkins, and Louis Marin was there, and the young Walter Ben Michaels. And just a whole series of these things are kind of very determining for a life. So nothing was of more interest to Frank and me and Darby during those years than Pollock and Pollock's achievements. I mean, what was clear was, I mean, there was an incredible explosion of painting, modernist painting, that took place in New York in the 1940s and 50s, it's just, and 60s even. It's just astonishing. You just sort of list all the names. But Newman and Still and Rothko and Pollock, and just remarkable, okay? Really with very little to support it conceptually. I mean, what did Newman think he was doing? And if you look at the career, you'll see there are years when he isn't painting. I mean, he's so far out. He's like one of these cartoon figures who's walked off a roof. You know, there's nothing underneath him. Pollock was this other kind of figure, but the all-over drip pictures of 47, 50 just remain, you know, were then and remain to this day. This kind of knee plus ultra pictorial achievement. You know, we're still, I think Michael would agree, we're still coming to terms with those things. And we just had a little glimpse of the Museum of Modern Art's number one, 1948. Well, there it was. It was at MoMA. But to be interested in contemporary art, modern art, in those years, to some extent still, but in those years, you know, being American was a big advantage, you know, because you had MoMA. And MoMA then was not the horrible corporate department store people mover that it is now. I mean, it still has a lot of great art in it, but it's in some fundamental way depressing to be there, to go through it. It's just not what it should be. But in those years, it was perfect. And it was small, and the pictures looked great, and the spaces were contemplative. It wasn't about moving a maximum number of bodies, you know, through it, you know, on escalators. I mean, that's what I think museum going has become virtually everywhere now. But that wasn't what it was like. And so you had this, you know, really astonishing picture to look at and talk about and go up against. And let's say all that was thrilling, and it was clear that Pollock was this incontournable figure, right, that one had to try to come to terms with. My earliest writings on Pollock, I'll just say a little bit and then I'll stop. My earliest writings, I mean, for me, this is terrific that we're having this evening. Because my writings on Pollock go back to the very beginning of my sort of writing seriously as a critic. And the sort of account that, you know, would always get cited, the idea of an all-over line that, you know, does away with figuration, that no longer bounds forms, so on and so forth. I wrote that in the spring of my second year of graduate school. It was the first time for the spring of 1964 as a little talk at Harvard. And then I sort of, in a way that I tend to do, stayed with it and tried to unpack it further. As some of you will know, I mean, the terms in which that essay is cast, in terms of something called a space addressed to eyesight alone, opticality, and so forth, whatever the limitations of that point of view, for a long time, associated with the rise of October and certain developments in criticism, it was presented as if it was some kind of ultimate sin against revealed religion. I mean, the idea of opticality was just, it was as if I had committed opticality, and that this was, just one of the vilest things that any human being could ever dream of doing. So we had a whole set of issues around these concepts, which I think, in retrospect, look not deeply interesting. The idea was opticality, or anything about anything like that, was just the enemy, and, to be expunged from any form of critical discourse. What was very important for me, and I would, this is a basic fact about the way I wrote about Pollock, and no doubt it's a limitation, is that for me, trying to come to terms with Pollock was in large measure determined by an involvement with the stained paintings of Morris Lewis. So, crucially for me, writing about Pollock was already, as recent as he was, as recent as 4750 was, I was writing in the early 60s, it was an attempt to provide a kind of foreground for Lewis and the breakthrough into the stained pictures. The early veils, 1954, the later veils, fundamentally 58, 59, maybe a bit of 57, then the unbelievable unfurls of 1960, and then the stripes of 61, 62, and he dies at 49 and 62. To this day, I regard Lewis as a great painter. And those paintings as a huge achievement. That's still not, I mean, there's a whole larger topic here, which has to do with the relative eclipse of color field painting, right, in the world today, in the wake of minimalism and literalism and the general idea that a painting should be gray, anything between gray and pewter. But anything else is a real problem. It should more or less look like and behave like a refrigerator. Sculpture, too, if it could possibly do it. So the attempt to sort of provide this background to Lewis led to thinking about Pollock, and it led to a focus on certain kinds of issues of what I then called figuration. Right, and then the role of drawing, and part of the account of Lewis that seemed to me important and went against the grain was to talk about the importance of issues ultimately relating to drawing, subtending Lewis's innovations in color, rather than simply settling for the idea that Lewis was a great colorist. Anyway, that's the background. That's some of the background to that, and then there are other little things where I write about Pollock over the years, but crucially in 1989, when the Pollock show was at MoMA, I wrote an essay about that show. I was actually in Italy that year, but I went back and saw that show. And I wrote an essay that appeared in Art Forum, which appeared under the horrible title, to my mind, Optical Allusions. The essay was called Pollock's Intensity. But Art Forum at that time was committed to hideously playful titles. So we got Optical Allusions. I almost passed out when I saw it. I hadn't been told that they'd changed the title. The magazine came, I opened the magazine. And it was just like totally depressing moment. So in my CV, it says Optical Allusions, square brackets, Pollock's Intensity. And someday, if I ever republish it, it will be called Only Pollock's Intensity. Anyway, that's an essay that Michael says very generous things about. I honestly hadn't reread that essay. I hadn't looked at that essay from 1989 until the last few weeks preparing for this evening. I mean, I didn't even have a copy. I had to, you know, go back and sort of order it through the library. I won't say anything about it, but for me, that essay is very much also on the table here, and it reviews some of the issues that, you know, that I've just said a little bit about. So, okay, that's really the background. This very early writing about Pollock, in part as preparation, as setting up a framework or context for talking about Lewis, and then I'm going to keep calling Pollock's Intensity. So that's, I think, I take it what, for the most part, we're talking about. And now I'm just happy to, forgive me for going on so long, but I'm happy to take questions.